Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America: The First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we're still in the middle of a beautiful montage in minute 82. Lots of mayhem, lots of happenings, lots of angry guys that look like skulls. Hal, tell us all about it.
Well, I think you just did, Jim. You took care of that for us.
Oh, just flesh it out a bit.
It is amazing that this minute is only 60 seconds because there is a lot crammed in here. Minute 82. Atop a massive Hydra tank, Steve Rogers, as Captain America, reaches through the open hatch and yanks the driver out, hoisting him into the air. Falsworth tosses a satchel charge, which Steve drops down the hatch. He slams it shut and leaps off as the tank erupts in a thunderous explosion, flames roaring behind him. At the smoldering ruins of another Hydra factory, the Red Skull looms over Dr. Arnim Zola, his voice seething. "You are failing! We are close to an offensive that will shake the planet if we are continually delayed because you cannot outwit a simpleton with a shield." Zola, defensive, adjusts his glasses. "This is hardly my area of expertise. I merely develop the weapons. I cannot fire them." "Finish your mission, Doctor," the Red Skull snaps, "before the American finishes his." Two Hydra guards drag a disheveled man in a suit forward. The man pleads. "Sir, I'm sorry, Herr Schmidt. We fought to the last man." The Red Skull draws a futuristic pistol, his eyes cold. "Evidently not." He fires, and the man is exterminated. The scene shifts to a snowy mountain pass where Steve and his howling commando stand on a rocky ledge, gazing at a rail line far below. A long cable stretches from their perch to the tracks, taut against the wind.
Lovely.
Hal, so much happening here.
I'd like to open by complimenting you, Hal. I don't think I could say satchel charge as much as you have had to say in the last couple of minutes.
Well, I had to do that. It took a couple of takes.
Try it five times fast. Satchel charge. It's a tough combo. And you do it like a pro.
Well, I am in the future just going to refer to it as an O'Kane bomb, if that's okay. I think that's just a nice.
Well, they used to call me Satch in high school. Yes. Yeah. I do like the beautiful pedantry of the Red Skull. he points, "Oh, not exactly to the last man."
Yeah, you better recheck your math there, pal.
Yeah. It's just right up there with that. This just isn't your day, is it?
Exactly. Well, and that tank at the beginning is, I mean, there's so much.
Oh my God.
That tank is so big. It's just so big. It's fantastic.
It's like a five story tall tank.
Yeah.
Didn't they have something called like a Goethe tank or something that was like that? It was like this massive cannon. I think it was one of those secret weapons of the SA or something.
Of the Wehrmacht. Yeah.
They were making a giant, like howitzer, but I don't know if it was a tank.
I don't think there was ever anything this tall. I think you kind of take what, you know, some of the crazy ideas they were tinkering with and had on paper and then say, let's make that three times that size.
Yeah, this looks like something that would best be used in, like, Ringling Brothers maybe might have some applications for it.
Right.
It is almost a cartoony tank with that giant barrel poking out of it.
Yeah. Yes. And the other four barrels poking out of just around the tire treads. It has like multiple machine guns and just bristling with any kind of weaponry that they can shoot in any direction. Right. So,
yeah, that even that secondary turret or the main gun that has two barrels. I mean, those are huge already. I mean, those could be, you know, 105 millimeter or something absolutely insane. So that big one is just absolutely just bonkers.
I kind of expect to see Hydra guys flying out of it as it shoots, you know?
Yeah.
Like human cannonballs, literal right. Human cannonballs.
You know, speaking of sort of circuses and acrobatics and things, I'm very entertained by going a couple of seconds in and sort of scrubbing back and forth, because the choreography of you know, Cap grabs the guy and he flings them up. Yep. And then here comes the satchel charge. I said it again. And the charge is going up as the guy is falling. I mean, it's almost like Cap is here sort of juggling. It's just beautiful how these two matching parabolas, like here comes the charge, it's up and over as the guy is falling behind him that he's thrown out of the way. It's fantastic.
And I've got to ask, do you guys think that's a Wilhelm scream as he comes out of there? Like, oh.
I was wondering maybe it might have been one of the alternate takes of the Wilhelm. I was wondering whose phone number that is on the inside of the hatch, because it's 342-3435. So that might be.
Let's give it a call.
Yeah.
We don't know the area code, but let's give it a call.
You know, that's funny. I hadn't thought about that. My first phone number. Now, I don't know what I had for breakfast this morning, but from 1968 until 1976, my phone number was 415-342-1279.
Okay, well, this could have been, you know, Marin County. This might be an ILM deal.
If you want to put 415 in front of it. Is that still the main area code for Northern California?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Yes.
Well, we'll leave that as
a... more and more, but...
Hal, why don't you get on the phone right now and let's give these people a call and ask
coming to you live.
What's your phone number doing on a Hydra tank? but yeah, I wouldn't doubt that might be the main number for ILM.
You know, if we had any guts at all, we would pretend to call that number and we'd have a stooge set up and we'd open with that. What's your number doing on a Hydra tank? And they would just say, I knew this day would come. we could have planned this whole thing.
Even as we speak, I am dialing this just to see what happens.
Are you?
Okay. This is wrong.
Yeah, don't I make apologize my calls, in advance. Kids.
Hang on.
He's doing it.
We are working without a net.
He's doing it. This is like a morning zoo radio show right now. This is awful.
Exactly. I need a soundboard.
This is not where I saw my life going. This kind of no. Jim's got a furrowed brow. He's looking concerned.
Yeah.
I'm not sure anything's happening.
Lots of dead air. Furtively. They're just ringing and ringing. I guess they got tired of answering the phone from so many people pausing their DVDs.
Yeah. Okay, now try 8675309.
Yes. Starting with every area code. So anyway, that was an interesting experiment, but unfortunately, no answer. But if you do have that number, please give us a reach back. We appreciate hearing from you at our Facebook page on Camp Lehigh. But wow, well, that was a nice try, but... yeah, somebody must know. It's always a possibility.
So the tank bit ends with another iconic shot of that sort of mirrors the earlier shot of Captain America jumping through the air with a big flaming fireball behind him.
Right.
It's another beautiful shot, and it's just another one just taken right from the pages of the comics of this is what Captain America should look like, you know. And I was attuned to that because, you know, it's easy, relatively easy to make someone like Iron Man fly. It's relatively easy to do some of the more heroic stuff. But I think it's maybe harder to make a character like Captain America who's just barely superhuman. You know, he's
right
as strong as a human being can be. He's as agile and fast as a human being can be. But he's not. He's not Superman. He can't fly like Iron Man. So I think there's kind of almost an uncanny valley there of it's got to look really right for Captain America.
Yeah, it's almost like he's doing – what it reminded me of is what college broad jumpers look like when they're trying to get that extra few inches. They just kind of throw their shoulders forward and the rest of the body mass follows behind. I'm thinking now. I don't remember who. What was it? Steve Ditko that said that Superman has an extra organ in his chest that pulls him forward from his.
John Byrne said that. I can't believe you remember that. Well, you and I have talked about this before, but that was John Byrne's theory of. John Byrne was a well-renowned mostly artist, but also occasional writer of mostly Marvel comics. But he did Superman for a while, and. He was very careful about not only giving all of his characters different facial expressions because, you know, there's a joke in DC Comics that Superman and Batman happen, Bruce Wayne and Clark Kent happen to look an awful lot alike so much that they can disguise as each other. but a lot of artists only have three or four male faces and three or four female faces. Byrne went out of his way to give everybody a unique, distinct face and body type And way of flying, so that Superman didn't fly like Iron Man, didn't fly like Thor, didn't fly like this. And he always thought this through about, well, how do they fly? And Superman, he always thought, flew kind of chest out with his arms back behind him, just is leading with his chest, because he thought that was kind of where Superman's energy center was in his chest. So that's the part that propelled him. Whereas Iron Man is, you know, he's boot jets. So he's propelled from the back, from the bottom of his feet. And so Byrne would draw him like that. And it was really interesting. Once I saw Byrne say that in an interview, or read it in an interview, I started to look for it. And it's really apparent in his work and not many other people's, but it's a neat touch.
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense. And it does make him look very heroic as he's flying, because he's usually his chest is flying right at the reader, at the viewer. So it gives you some great angles. I am wondering about the Red Skull's magnificent leather overcoat there, that double-breasted. To me, it reminds me of a long version of the Rocketeer's outfit with the
buttons. Have shades of that. Yeah, there was I'm trying to blank on the name of it. When we were in the action figure business and producing uniforms and things for World War II uniforms for 12-inch figures, there was a leather great coat that was a police great coat. It was similar to this in length, and it was actually a little bit more Rocketeer-esque, the double-breasted portion at the top. Didn't have the buttons down the side, but then, you know, you had a similar belt buckle, but with a, you know, Wehrmacht emblem on it. You had a true collar and lapels, unlike what he's wearing here. But you could see that person, you know, traditional German army person, standing in this same scene, and he would fit right in.
All right, yeah, it's
a terrific coat.
It really is. It reminds me of I remember when I was a kid in New York City. The New York City police used to have these great coats that were about almost quite, and not quite ankle length, but they were double breasted and they're very imposing. Actually, if you watch the Star Trek episode, the original series, Assignment Earth, the two police officers that accidentally get beamed up to the Enterprise, they're both wearing the New York City greatcoats.
Oh, sure.
And it's you can't really run after somebody wearing that, but again,
that was also the days of the Sam Brown belt.
Yes,
where
you had
the duty belt around the waist and then a single diagonal strap over one shoulder going to the belt in the front and the back. That was such a classic thing.
I hadn't really studied the skull costume, but this is a really neat design in that it's almost but not quite symmetrical. And they did that in a lot of the Marvel, especially early Marvel costume designs. You know, one of my daughters actually was a cosplay seamstress for a while, and she duplicated the Captain America costume from the first Avengers movie. And it seems very simple until you start studying it, and you see it's got layers upon layers and textures upon textures and slightly different shades of blue, and it's very slightly asymmetrical. The Red Skull's costume is also looks simple at first, but when you study it, the asymmetry is interesting. I don't think there's really different textures. It looks like it's all shiny black leather, but there's a lot going on that kind of catches and teases and interests the eye in a way that you're not really conscious of.
There's something going across the collarbone that goes. Yeah. There's like two. It looks like you put on like bib overalls for the front of the costume,
right,
on top of what looks like some kind of a shoulder, you know, it's like a rubber shoulder thing that fits over, but still leaves room for the epaulette, so you can see his rank, which of course I guess the rank of Red Skull. So
and that over the shoulder thing, you know what that. I mean, this is obviously not that, but what it makes me think of, if you imagine turning that around so that, you know, that longer, wider spot went around his back, that's what like a shoulder holster looks like.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You've got one shoulder open and, you know, then the holster's hanging in the armpit, then the other piece goes over. It's a similar structure.
Well, let me blow your mind here. I think if you look at it like that, it looks a little like what Captain America holds his shield on his back with, except in the front.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, agreed.
Great. He's a backwards Captain America. Oh, my God. Thematic brilliance.
Thematic brilliance. And then he also has that diagonal sort of Sam Brown style belt. That,
right, yeah.
That, you know, just an extra harness that's going under, you know, under the overall piece of it, that sort of harness piece. And there's a lot going on.
Now, do they make Sam Browns for Southpaws? I was just wondering if there's a left-handed holster carrier, because you really can't, it's not reversible. It doesn't seem to be reversible.
That's a good question, whether it did or not. And what I don't know how that would work if, does the holster itself have to be connected to where the two belts meet, the waist one and then the over the shoulder one? Or was that just there, just a sort of an overall, like one suspender to help hold the belt up?
You can get a Sam Brown belt with a left shoulder strap for $100.
All right,
then. Glendale, yeah.
Okay. Out now. Here we go. Yeah. I'm also noticing, since we're really diving into this costume, up around 50, 51 seconds of this minute, you can see a slightly closer version of the Red Skull, and you can see that his Hydra emblem on his shoulder is red, and he's also got some red piping that I didn't notice in earlier parts of the scene. Yeah. He's got some red piping there, and that red is the same red as his face, man. It's just like, wow, that was not an accident.
No, it's totally on brand.
I'm just wondering who went up to his face with the paint swatches and said, "Ah, here you go, here, Skull."
Well, maybe they consulted the artist guy.
Yeah, the guy who was painting his portrait.
Yeah,
so we have a little of that. It's neat too that the that Hydra emblem is, is 3D. There's real depth to it, and it doesn't look embroidered to me. It looks more like it's, carved out of presumably leather.
Yeah, it almost looks like a bar coaster. Like you could just park a drink on his shoulder.
You're welcome to try.
Yeah.
speaking of which, I just say we've seen Schmidt, evolve, and we've seen him as the Red Skull. This is not the big unveiling. And he's been sort of creepy and disturbing, but this minute to me is the first, or at least one of the first times that he's just genuinely scary.
Yeah.
When we're just up tight on him and he is screaming, and then he just blasts the guy. We've seen him kill other people, but somehow this, he's losing his cool a bit, and that makes him
losing his cool
more upsetting.
Yeah, exactly. He's not in control. He's angry, and it's showing. Yeah. Right.
And that beautiful underlighting when he pulls out his little ray gun and shoots, and it's just the whole underside of his face lights up. Just beautiful, showing his frustration and anger that things aren't going his way.
Hal, I think that's a great observation. And I also note, too, that he's not bothering to disguise himself anymore. It's like he's embraced his Red Skulliness, maybe particularly since meeting Captain America. When we first saw him, he was wearing a rubber mask, and he doesn't bother with that anymore.
Right. He's just all the gloves are off, the mask is off, et cetera. The gloves are on, but metaphorically speaking, they're off. So something that was never super clear to me, and maybe this is really obvious and I've just missed it, but this, the poor man who gets blasted at the end of this minute, who's saying we fought to the last man, he's in civilian clothes. Is he have we seen him before? Is he somebody that, is it obvious to somebody else why he's not a German, a Wehrmacht soldier or another Hydra soldier? Is he just a guy working in the Hydra labs?
That's what I took him to be. I don't think we've seen him before.
No, I think he's more like the shift supervisor that's a civilian contractor for Hydra, and he's building more of those guns. Or maybe he's making pieces for the America bomber that Red Skull is hoping for.
I didn't note that, but, Zola's in civvies. I think he's more of the science division, like Jim said, maybe a upper management kind of guy.
That's kind of what I was thinking. It's just, it was interesting to me that, I guess Zola just got yelled at for not shooting at Captain America. So everybody's expected to take up arms, even though you're thinking, okay, there should be Hydra soldiers there that are protecting the civilians and the management people from the commandos and things. But clearly the expectation from Red Skull is if you're there, don't come out alive without taking some of them with you.
Yeah. And Zola's so funny too. When Red Skull says, evidently not, or apparently not, Zola just turns his head. Joe Johnston gets a shot of him. Just, no, dude, that was the wrong thing to say, man. Not that there's anything he could have said to save his life at that point, but Zola's just, oh no.
Yeah, and Zola sees the writing on the wall.
He knows what's coming.
Yeah. And is Zola wearing the, I can't remember. It's a golden party badge. It's the first 100,000 members of the Nazi Party got a special badge that they wore, showing that they were with Hitler back in the, in the during the beer whore push and stuff like that.
It gives that impression, but if you zoom in like right at 45 seconds, it is clearly just a Hydra. It's the Hydra emblem. It matches Skull's belt buckle and things.
Okay, yeah, I was just trying. I couldn't figure it out from just looking at it on my screen, but it bears a remarkable resemblance to that. I probably it's the Golden Partizeichen, I think is the way it's pronounced, but it's the Golden Party badge. But I guess maybe he melted it down and turned it into a Hydra badge.
Again, depending on who was writing the checks.
But yeah, it's supposedly, I mean, Zola's been part of one party or another since the beginning. I think he found where whoever was going to be, yeah, like you said, whoever was cutting the checks, he'd wear their little ribbon. Zola's such a fascinating character. I think he's one of the most fascinating parts of the movie, of just he's a survivor by being he's I wouldn't say that he's feigning weakness, but he offers no resistance. There's nothing to push against, so he's ignored.
Right. But he's still, for somebody who, he's so brilliantly portrayed, as we've discussed it at length, but for somebody who is presenting this weakness, no resistance thing, he does talk back to Red Skull more than most. You know,
But
he does, he's standing up for himself a little bit when he's saying, I just design the weapons, I don't shoot them. And he's in trouble and he's getting a lecture, but he's not getting murdered on the spot.
Right.
I think he knows he knows the skull needs him, and the skull knows he knows that. So he gives him a little latitude, I think. But yeah, Toby Jones is just fantastic in this. But he's just such a weasel. It's fantastic.
Wow. Absolutely.
Well, this scene, this minute is in two parts. I mean, we see what happens when you fail. I mean, this guy, the one guy, got Admiral Ozzled out of the way, and we cut to the Howling Commandos up on a mountaintop, about to conduct some kind of a mission that we'll get into in future episodes. But I do love the fact that Hydra seems to have its own little portable Enigma machine. That the similarity to an Enigma is incredible, and with all the little Hydra sextuplet, sextupus. I'm not sure what you call the
It's a sextuple, yeah.
sextupus.
Hexapus.
Hexapus, maybe. Who? Yes, it's got as many logos as you can fit on a little black box.
Yeah, Jim, you pointed this out before we started recording, and I hadn't noticed at all, first of all, that the Howling Commandos are using a stolen, evidently stolen Hydra communication device. And second of all, it's got a keyboard and then a keyboard like display above it that looks exactly like the Enigma machine. I hadn't noticed any of that. So thank you for bringing increasing improving my depth of understanding of this film. It's a neat looking machine.
Yeah,
and
it's not. And I keep thinking, I don't know that much about old manual typewriters, but I do recognize the keys themselves are from an Underwood. That's an Underwood style keyboard.
Oh, sure.
So I don't.
And the other nice thing to point out is the German layout of the keyboard. So we're used
Yes.
to QWERTY in German. It's Quartz. The Z is up there, and
Yeah.
then Y is down below next to, I believe that's the S set.
Yes, and
So Y is where Z is, and there's one extra
and
character next to it.
P is down where the Z would be, I think, next to, or to the left of it. What am I? I'm
I
looking
was
at
trying
my
to tell if that's a
keyboard.
P or if that's a Z, or if that's P or if that's the S set,
Oh
which is
yeah.
kind of the funky B
The
in German. Nope, the S set is over next to the V, where, well, or but it looks like a B, so that might also just be a B. Anybody out there have a German typewriter we could borrow just briefly? I suppose
Call
we
that
could.
number. Yes,
Yes,
yes.
hello.
I have to use the special decoder first to talk to
Oh,
them.
right. And I love also on this machine, the lid is open and all the instructions are up there. There's a
Yes,
guide,
yes.
there's a
Yeah.
key. I would just, would you just love to be able to just look at that and yes. step through it and see what maybe what Easter eggs are in there and
I love,
what the
I
logic
love,
was.
It has the fine tuner next to the gross tuner. The gross tuner is in the middle, and then right. the fine tuner is that little wheel that you can. It has a little handle on the side of the on the top of the wheel that you can spin it a couple of times to get just the right frequency.
Right.
Just a beautiful piece of what would be German engineering at the time.
And you know, it's funny that little fine tuner wheel, that kind of, you know, it's circular, but there's it's almost like little flower petals or sort of the
little finger ridge.
It.
Yeah.
That looks to me exactly like a 40s era, like World War II Army Air Corps, a throttle friction lock. Knob. Huh. Like as soon as I looked at it. So like the airplane I grew up flying had a knob. Exactly like that. And the only reason that it connects is like I looked at it and suddenly I could imagine exactly what it felt like in my hand. And that's just, it's a little thing that as you move the throttles back and forth, you think of that like an accelerator in a car. But unlike a car, oftentimes you need to put that throttle to a position and then set it and leave it there. And sometimes you want to loosen or tighten the friction of it. So it's either it's easy to move or you want to tighten it. So it's not going to move much if you jostle it. That kind of thing. So, I mean, it could be any kind of Bakelite knob from back then, but that shape was so instantly familiar when I stopped and looked.
Yeah. Is Dum Dum carrying a Sten? I was trying to figure out what kind of weapon he was holding there, but it looked kind of, it didn't look like a BAR to me, but I didn't know.
No, it's too small to be a BAR, and I think it's too long to be a Sten. It almost looks like a shotgun, to be honest.
It almost looks like a shotgun.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I can see that. Kind of far away for a shotgun, but maybe
we'll have to see if he uses it in future minutes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you were
going to say just from a filmmaking perspective, this is a terrific establishing shot that shows us the Howling Commandos and Captain America are on a mountain. We can see the railroad track below them, and we can see a cable line running from higher above them on the mountain down toward the valley that the train tracks are going on. This one shot shows you exactly what's going to happen for the next 5 minutes of this movie.
Yeah.
It really sets the scene.
Even though it's a green screen, the parallax is astonishing. I mean, it gives you the idea of how far up the mountain they are to jump on this train. So we're setting up the danger and the deadliness for the following minute. But
also some very smart atmospheric extinction, just the clouds and fog that are kind of in the way between the Howling Commandos and the distant, even further distant mountain. It really gives you a really sweet sense of depth and distance.
Right. And it's great how, you know, the first thing we see is we see Falstaff there in his wonderful British para uniform. You know, but we're tight on him looking in binoculars. So we know he's looking at something far away. We know there's going to be in the next shot. We're expecting to see some distance, but then you get a little bit of vertigo when you see they're all standing on the side of the mountain. And then, you know, we're panning up just a little bit and realizing these guys are way up there. And as you said, we know what's coming.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we'll talk about that in our next episode. But I think we covered a lot of ground here, from exploding bits and the Red Skull's uniform to standing on top of a snowy mountain.
German typewriters.
So very quickly, as we're on our way out, I did just double check. Dum Dum is carrying a Winchester 1897, a 12-gauge shotgun, also often referred to as a trench gun.
Trench gun. Okay.
So I was able to get a closer look on another site and do a little internet cheating.
I guess if he's climbing up on the mountain, the only people that he's worried about, he's not worried about shooting anybody down in the valley, but anybody coming up behind them on the ridge, that should take care of them quite nicely without a lot of aiming. Wow. Well,
it's called research. It's not cheating. It's research, you know.
Rapid research.
It's such a fine line between cheating and research, but
you can't do it during Final Jeopardy, but everything else it's okay. Thanks everybody for joining us for this episode. If you'd like to continue the conversation, as you know, we are always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like the show, don't forget to subscribe wherever and leave a like it wherever the streaming service was that you found this episode. Also, if you have that phone number we'd asked about earlier, we'd love to hear from you too. Also, please check out our big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
Do this all day.